gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Goldhammer against Nagode. Mr. Norberg.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The District Court in this case disregarded the Supreme Court's admonition that facial invalidation should be used only sparingly and as a last resort. Subsection D of the City of Chicago's Disorderly Conduct Ordinance enables the city to fulfill its fundamental responsibility for keeping the peace by allowing police officers to order the dispersal of crowds around public disturbances. In this case, the parties have stipulated to the dismissal with prejudice of all of plaintiffs' as-applied claims against the ordinance. Therefore, the only thing left for this court is determination of whether or not the district court erred in determining that the ordinance on its face violates the First Amendment and is impermissibly vague. This morning, I'd like to focus my remarks on the First Amendment and vagueness issue. And with regard to the First Amendment overbreadth issue, I will stand on my brief unless this court has specific questions. It's worthwhile to begin this morning by talking about specifically what subsection D regulates. As construed by the Illinois Supreme Court, the ordinance is triggered in situations where there are three or more persons who are acting in such unreasonable manner as to provoke, make, or aid in making a breach of the peace, and their disorderly conduct is...
So what is the relation between the issue here and the issue before the Supreme Court in Humanitarian Law Project?
Humanitarian Law Project.
Well, if that doesn't ring a bell, you obviously can't answer my question. But there is a case before the Supreme Court which poses the question whether a statute raises First Amendment issues because of its vagueness.
Conceivably, I think...
argued last month.
Humanitarian Law Project.
Don't speculate, counsel. If you don't know the case, talking off the top of your head won't help.
He's got a laptop tweaking.
Understood. I will look into that case for my own edification, Your Honor.
Mr. Norberg?
Yes.
What indication do we have that Section 10D was actually violated in this case?
I was looking
for some indication that there were three or more people acting in a disorderly way.
In this case, it's true, Judge Hamilton, that the record as it stands now doesn't seem to necessarily establish a violation of D as it was applied against the plaintiffs here. So were this an as-applied challenge, had the as-applied challenge proceeded to trial and further into discovery, then it's very likely, or at least very possible, that plaintiffs could have established an as-applied Section D claim. We do not dispute that it was certainly...
You settled those claims, right?
Yes.
But what I'm wondering about, and what I'd like to hear from the plaintiffs as well, is without any real indication that Section 10D was actually violated here, why is this an appropriate case for trying to resolve the interesting question of the facial validity of the ordinance?
I think that this is the appropriate case to the extent that determining the facial validity of the ordinance does not necessarily have anything to do with the specific application in this case. The ordinance was enforced against them, so they have standing to challenge it as a general matter. And for that reason, I think it's legitimate, and it was certainly appropriate for them to also include a facial challenge in their complaint.
If a policeman comes up to you and says, "I'm arresting you for witchcraft," right, and there's no rule against witchcraft, does that create a right to challenge this ordinance because this ordinance might have been used? Right. If this ordinance was never properly applied to them, and if the claim of improper application has been settled and dismissed, why is there any remaining case or controversy about this statute?
To the extent they challenge this ordinance as applied as a violation of their First Amendment rights. Now, I appreciate and definitely understand, based on the way the Supreme Court has looked at these issues, that often the way it plays out is that there's a determination essentially on due process or probable cause grounds that the evidence does not establish a violation of the ordinance. And that's how the court determines that the as-applied claim or the arrest was bad. However, you can also say that this arrest, an arrest or enforcement of an ordinance to you, violates your First Amendment rights as applied. And in this case, that is what they said. Now, it hasn't been...
It may be what they said, right? But you come back to my witchcraft case, right? They're arrested on a completely spurious charge, and now we get to challenge anything that might have been applied to us but wasn't.
Application in this case, and I think this is borne out by the case law, was the enforcement of the ordinance against them. The arrest...
I think you're missing the point of Judge Hamilton's question in mind, which is their contention, and perhaps this is implicit in the settlement, this ordinance was never properly applied to them. The facial challenge presumably has to do with proper applications of this ordinance, things actually within its scope. And if that's never happened to these plaintiffs, and may never happen to these plaintiffs, one wonders why we're here.
I certainly appreciate that, and that may very well provide a basis for decision in this case, the determination that once the as-applied challenge fell by the wayside or was not developed or determined to actually represent an actual application of the law against them that was legitimate except insofar as the law provides, but was illegitimate, unconstitutional insofar as it violated the First Amendment rights of the plaintiffs. To the extent that that has not been developed or that has not been established, then perhaps, as I said at the beginning, this is not a case for facial validation because that is what you go to as a last resort. The Supreme Court has definitely encouraged courts to not jump to facial consideration, but rather to look at as-applies claims. So I agree, Chief Judge Easterbrook, that perhaps in this case the court might say this issue is not squarely presented enough to allow determination of the facial validity. However, were the court to look to the facial validity for the reasons we've argued, we would say that as a matter of law, the determination of the district court was flawed in two fundamental respects, both of the determinations, both of the holdings, both on vagueness and First Amendment grounds, were fundamentally flawed. And to turn first to the First Amendment issue, it's important to note that subsection D does not regulate expression at all. It only regulates conduct, excuse me. And it is very clear that a municipality has the right to regulate conduct that might incidentally, in some cases, burden expression, as long as the regulation is not content-based and as long as the regulation is being applied across the board and non-pretextually. Of course, were it to be applied pretextually, that would be a case-specific determination, and it would be a case where the plaintiff who was alleging something along the lines of a selective enforcement sort of type claim would present that argument in the context of the facts of their case. It says nothing about the facial validity of the ordinance.
But would you agree that Section 10D can be applied in an unconstitutional manner?
It can be applied in an unconstitutional manner only in the same way that any law could be applied in an unconstitutional manner.
Not in the sense that any law can be applied. This one has the unique potential to create a heckler's veto. I don't know whether that's unique, right? But this is what obviously got the district judge most concerned. If a crowd gathers that doesn't like the speakers, this law has the potential to stop the speech rather than, as the First Amendment commands, controlling the hecklers.
You're absolutely right, and I didn't mean to oversimplify by saying that. What I intended in response to Judge Hamilton's question was to say that as long as it is being applied in good faith and not being applied as a heckler's veto.
Being applied not to do that, it has to be.
It doesn't have
much to do with the officer's good faith. It might seem the most sensible thing in the world to a police officer on the beat to prevent the disruption in the most efficient way possible, which is to hustle the speaker and his squadron of aides off the stand.
Yeah.
This really is ripe for abuse.
I don't mean to dwell on a truism by saying that it's constitutional as long as it's not applied unconstitutionally yet. But the fact is that applying...
No, I understand. That leads to your argument that it would be an improper application, right? So you might agree or might have agreed to an injunction against using this law to create a heckler's veto.
Sure. Well, we might have.
You might have. But, of course, the as-applied challenge, you say, has been dismissed.
Exactly. And I think as implicit in your Honor's question, a heckler's veto issue is the quintessential as-applied situation, unless you have a case like Forsyth County or the Gary Ku Klux Klan case out of this circuit, where there is a law that by its terms requires or enables, explicitly enables on its face, the government to make a decision that takes into account the heckler's concerns. Mm-hmm. In Forsyth County, the problem was that inevitably, in virtually every situation, the county was going to have to look at what was going to be said in order to assess how much security they were going to need at the particular event. And the Supreme Court noted that takes into account the hecklers and allows them to have a prospective veto, conceivably, over the speech that would be presented. But once again, that is not this type of case. Nothing in the ordinance encourages the police to target on its face. Nothing on the face of the ordinance.
Not on its face, but we look at the history of its application from August of 1968 forward, and we see it used in high-profile, large settings where the police face some of their greatest challenges and the First Amendment values are at their apex. So that's a serious concern here.
Absolutely. I think that in a particular instance, this case, this ordinance might be more susceptible, as Chief Judge Easterbrook was saying, than the typical ordinance or the typical law to being used in a manner to discourage First Amendment.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Norberg, in the Hodgkins case, this court said, in essence, there in the with the respect to the Indiana curfew, there needs to be a viable First Amendment exception for that statute to withstand scrutiny. One of the things that I was wondering about here has to do with some of these large events that are known in advance. I assume that Chicago requires permits for major parades or demonstrations or rallies.
That's my understanding, yes.
And those would be situations, it seems to me, where the potential for unconstitutional application is probably highest, this sort of heckler's veto. One can imagine, for example, election night in 2008, some folks who were upset at the rally in Grant Park might have been able to cause a disruption, and suddenly everybody there is committing a crime by refusing to disperse. Or next month there might be a Tea Party rally that some folks would like to disrupt by causing a ruckus on the edge and forcing that to be broken up. Would an exception where there's a permit work from your perspective?
Well, I think that it's important to note that the city code contemplates the possibility of hecklers vetoing protected expression. In the subsection C, which precedes subsection D, the code requires police to make reasonable efforts to protect otherwise peaceful conduct when there is an imminent threat of violence. Mm-hmm. And only if they have requested the said conduct and activity be stopped and explained the request when there is a clear and present danger of serious unrest can mm-hmm. they then cite the speakers. Mm-hmm. So this sort of recognizes an exception in that situation or recognizes a heckler's veto concept.
It recognizes it. I'm not sure it addresses the problem. Let me ask you, I guess, from a different angle. Obviously, Section 10D can be used to suppress protected speech. When that happens, I'm wondering if there's any kind of effective remedy at all. Presumably, an individual police officer would be able to say, as long as the conduct came within the four corners of the statute, I'm relying on the statute. I had probable cause. right?
Absolutely.
Could there be a possibility here that the city ordinance, by creating so much potential for First Amendment violations, is actually reflecting a Monell policy or even a custom of using this ordinance to suppress speech?
Well, there's certainly no express custom of using it to suppress speech. And it hasn't been, the Monell claim here hasn't been developed. That also was part of the settlement of all the rest of the, I believe, of all the remaining claims. To address your question of remedy, however, what the situation would involve in the enforcement as applied of this ordinance would be a situation, presumably, and this is, I assume, how this case would have proceeded had it gone to trial, where the principal argument by the plaintiff would be subsection D was not triggered. This was essentially a trumped-up charge. The police perceived conveniently for their own purposes three or more people creating a disorder that enabled them to order dispersal. So there would be a fact issue, as trials are, you know, trials are concerned with fact issues, and the fact issue here would be whether or not the ordinance was triggered, which is to say whether or not the application was a legitimate application of this law. If it wasn't, then the plaintiff's remedy would be there was no probable cause to arrest me. Any prosecution against me was not, had they been found liable, which they weren't, but in a case where someone was found liable.
It's a defense to the case.
Exactly.
You're into your rebuttal then.
I will reserve the rebuttal then. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Norberg. Ms. Wang.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first issue I'd like to address is the question that Judge Easterbrook posed about whether or not the fact that the as-applied challenge has been settled would render this case an inappropriate candidate for determining the facial challenge. I think Hodgkins answers that question, because in that case...
You think what?
Hodgkins versus Peterson. In that case, the plaintiffs did not even engage in First Amendment activity. The plaintiff... Colin Hodgkins and his friends had been arrested after they left a late-night soccer game from their school. What this court found important was that that was an appropriate case for overbreadth challenge due to the chilling effect. This court said
that... That's actually one reason why I asked my very first question, which is, what is the relation between this case and Humanitarian Law Project? Because you're using overbreadth the way the Ninth Circuit did in Humanitarian Law Project, and the Supreme Court's grant of certiorari implies that the justices themselves may not be persuaded by that approach. So what do you think is the relation between this case and Humanitarian Law Project?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I cannot answer that question.
Okay. Such is life.
As far as Hodgkins is concerned, though, this case is an appropriate case for an overbreadth challenge, and this court has held that even where the plaintiffs have not engaged in conduct that is itself protected, you can launch an overbreadth challenge where there's a substantial amount of conduct that's protected in relation to legitimate speech.
Ms. Wang, as I understand that area of the law, the reason that courts entertain those sorts of challenges is because the mere existence of the law on the books will chill protected expression.
Yes.
I have a little trouble seeing how that applies to Section 10D, which is not even triggered until a police officer on the spot, under stress, issues an order, says, you've got to break this up, you've got to disperse. So, and there's no way to anticipate in advance whether such an order will be given. So I'm wondering whether that chilling effect theory works for this kind of a statute. I mean, in the curfew example, it's just against the law for a young person to be out and about at 2 a.m., okay? with certain exceptions that were written into that Indiana law. But this is different. There's no violation until you're already out there on the streets, in the park, on the sidewalks, and an officer tells you, break it up, move on.
That's true, Your Honor. But as the Supreme Court has said in Morales, the law does not provide advance notice if all you need to know in order to be arrested is that you've disobeyed an order of a police officer. It certainly creates a chilling effect because you can't have any gathering that involves a boisterous crowd or spontaneous speech, or even if you're standing there listening to somebody who's speaking in a controversial manner, you can't know whether or not you're going to be ordered to disperse based on the facts that, you know, based on the elements in the ordinance itself.
But how does that prevent the event from occurring?
I see your point. It might not prevent it could prevent the event from occurring because you would know that there's a high risk of being arrested depending on whether or not the police officer on the scene deems the triggering acts of disorderly conduct to be annoying or inconvenient. So I think it certainly could prevent the event from even occurring. But and I think that in Hodgkins, the court recognized that a concrete possibility of arrest is enough to chill speech, and that's what we have here. I think the fundamental problem with the city's position is that it has consistently insisted on limitations in the ordinance that just are not present. For example, it asserts a legitimate government interest in protecting public safety, and we have no dispute with that general proposition. But the ordinance is not limited to circumstances in which public safety is endangered. It doesn't require breach of the peace, which is what disorderly conduct is defined as. Breach of the peace has been defined by the Illinois courts to mean any conduct that tends to cause public disorder or tend to disturb the public peace and quiet. That could be a limitless number of things that would cover a whole host of protected speech and assembly. Even with respect to the interest that the city has asserted, this ordinance is not narrowly tailored to meet that interest. And as the Supreme Court has said with respect to the O'Brien test, if an ordinance is not narrowly tailored, if it restricts more speech than is necessary to serve the government interest.
Ms. Wang, can I just ask,
yes,
do you think Section 10D was violated here?
I do, but I mean
that there was a group of three or more people engaged in.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay.
I suppose the problem with discussing the facts of this particular case is that all we have in terms of the record before this court is what's in the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I don't think that means that this court can't decide the facial challenge because in the overbreadth context, the Supreme Court and this court has said that even when the plaintiffs are not engaged in protected conduct themselves, they can bring a challenge where there's a chilling effect in terms of the ordinance. The second reason why this ordinance it should be struck down under the First Amendment is that it does not provide ample alternative channels of communication. In every situation, a police officer has unlimited discretion to disperse people to prevent them from reaching the intended audience, and this is the heckler's, part of this is the heckler's veto problem.
Counsel, that sounds very much like an as-applied challenge. You're saying there should be an order the use of this ordinance from implementing a heckler's veto. But that's not the injunction the district court actually entered. The district court entered an order that, say, allows Al Capone's henchmen to assemble and prevents the cops from dispersing people who are trying to rough up shopholders who won't pay protection. Right? Doesn't that suggest we've got a problem with this injunction?
I don't think so, Your Honor. This court in Weinberg said that where there are no discernible standards, no comprehensible standards given in the text of the ordinance itself, a good faith challenge, you can't assume that officers will act in accordance with good faith.
You do remember that Morales rejected a First Amendment complaint about Chicago's ordinance. I mean, now it sounds like you're urging us to take the contrary position in Morales, that there was a First Amendment problem because of vagueness. And we're also back to what's going on in Humanitarian Law Project.
Well, in Morales...
The Solicitor General's argument in Humanitarian Law Project is that vagueness and First Amendment concerns are really totally different, and that one shouldn't say, it's citing Morales, right, and that one shouldn't say, because this is vague, it must be unconstitutional on its face under the First Amendment. There is, at most, the argument goes in Humanitarian Law Project, an as-applied challenge.
Your Honor, I understand that the Morales Court rejected a First Amendment challenge, but that was I think that the gang loitering ordinance in that case was fundamentally different from the ordinance here. This ordinance prohibits, essentially, any group of people to gather where that gathering may result in a disturbance of the public peace and quiet. What that means, I think, is really anyone's guess. And as the Supreme Court has said in numerous breach of the peace cases from the 1960s, Cox versus Louisiana, Cantwell versus Connecticut. In all of those cases, the court has said that it is impermissible to make it a violation to disturb the peace on both due process and First Amendment grounds. And even in Coates itself, which was mostly a due process case, even in that case, the Supreme Court said that making it illegal to conduct yourself in a manner annoying to persons passing by violated the First Amendment.
You're not suggesting that every breach of the peace or disorderly conduct statute is unconstitutional, are you?
No, absolutely.
Sure is what it sounds like.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
It sounds like you're saying any law that can be misused against a speaker or any member of the audience is necessarily unconstitutional on its face. And it seems to me that every law can be misused. I don't know any law that can't be misused. You suppose the police charged the people in the audience with murder and took them all away and charged them with murder. That would be a terrible misuse of the murder statute, and it would stop the speech, but it wouldn't imply that the murder statute is unconstitutional, would it?
I think that this ordinance is a necessary precursor to engaging in protected speech and expression in a public forum, and that's what this court held in Hodgkins. I'm not saying that every disorderly conduct or breach of the peace statute is unconstitutional, and in fact, the city has only managed
All right. What disorderly conduct statutes are valid, on your view?
Well, if this ordinance contained a limitation such that bystanders could be dispersed only if they threatened public safety, or even where dispersal was necessary to protect public safety, that would make it a better statute in our minds.
I didn't ask whether it would be better. I'm asking...
That would make it constitutional.
Make it constitutional, in your view.
Yes. Because the only thing that needs to happen in order for somebody to be ordered to disperse and arrested if they don't disperse is that an officer on the scene deems the conduct of other people to be annoying. And as the Supreme Court has said, that's not a valid basis for that does not provide minimal guidelines for law enforcement. And going back to Judge Hamilton's point, the city has not managed to point to any other ordinances like the city of Chicago's. The main ordinance.
Hold on, let me come back to this statute. The actual statute says, right, acts of disorderly conduct in the immediate vicinity, which acts are likely to cause substantial harm or serious inconvenience. What's the difference between that and imperil public safety?
Well, conduct could certainly be, for example, one example I gave in my brief was if there's a group of abortion protesters that are holding up graphic photos of aborted fetuses, that could be annoying and tend to cause disturbance in the public peace and quiet, but that does not imperil public safety. Street musicians standing on Michigan Avenue could be...
So you think, a different way to put this is, you think there's just that the thing that's unconstitutional about this are the last two words, annoyance or alarm?
No, Your
Honor.
So
that if those words were deleted, the statute would be valid?
No, Your Honor, because substantial harm itself is also problematic. What does it mean, substantial
harm? What is the difference between substantial harm and endanger the public safety?
Well, it doesn't say substantial physical harm. Emotional harm, a person could be emotionally harmed by seeing pictures of aborted fetuses dead soldiers.
The next case, you would be standing here saying, endanger the public safety. That could include emotional danger as well as physical danger, and therefore that would be invalid.
Well, I would think that is invalid. Endangering the emotional public safety.
You've now told me that the very statute you said would pass constitutional muster is invalid. Could you give me something that you think would be valid?
There is a difference. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there's a difference between endangering public safety and something that will cause substantial harm to passersby. I don't think public safety is. I think that would be a legitimate governmental interest, and I don't think that that is unconstitutionally
vague. You want a redefinition of substantial harm?
I'm sorry?
You want a redefinition of substantial harm? Substantial harm seems to me to be sufficient in itself. What is mysterious about that?
What constitutes substantial harm could include things that are clearly constitutionally protected conduct.
It's possible, but it's also possible that substantial harm by itself is not a real shocking concept. If you can envision substantial harm, why do you have to define it any closer than that?
I don't think that merely saying substantial harm would solve the problems with this ordinance because the Supreme Court has held in other cases involving breach of the peace ordinances that are defined in terms of substantial harm or disruption to public order, it has held that those things are unconstitutionally vague. And I think if substantial harm were interpreted to mean endangering public safety, that would be a constitutional ordinance.
So you say substantial harm to wit, public safety.
Yes.
That would be okay?
I think that would be okay.
All right.
With respect to the heckler's veto problem that I think is inherent in this ordinance is that in every situation in which people are engaged in controversial speech or listening to controversial speech, there exists a heckler's veto. The city points to Forsyth, but as the Supreme Court and other courts have held, whether giving weight to the listener's reaction to speech is the key to the heckler's veto, whether it's prospective or retrospective. So if the language of the statute as read by the officers on the scene would allow or disallow speech depending on the reaction of the audience, then it creates a heckler's veto. And I think that the very terms of the ordinance do permit a heckler's veto. And the one question that Judge Hamilton asked was with respect to whether this ordinance constitutes a unconstitutional policy pursuant to Monell. And I think that it certainly does. The final policymaker in the city of Chicago is the city council. You can have a Monell violation if there's an official policy that's been passed by city council, which undoubtedly an ordinance that was passed by city council is. I think, as I said in the beginning, the fundamental problem with this ordinance is that the city defines its interest narrowly or interprets the text of the ordinance to contain limitations that don't exist and that the Illinois courts have not interpreted to contain. And I don't think that this court can read into the statute limitations that the Illinois courts have not said it contains. So I think the fundamental problem is that it's not narrowly tailored to deal with public safety. There's no freestanding interest or general interest in protecting public order. In every situation in which somebody is engaged in controversial speech, there exists a heckler's veto. With respect to the vagueness issue, the city has said, the city disputes are the standard that's applicable. But as we pointed out, Justice Breyer said that where the vagueness problem with the statute is that it provides too much discretion to a police officer in every situation, then it is necessarily vague in every application. And the example that Justice Breyer gave in his concurrence in Morales is that if you had a law that said it's a crime to do wrong and you wanted to convict a murderer under it, you could not apply that law to that person because in every application that law would be vague.
You don't want to talk about the federal statute making it a crime to deprive somebody of honest services, do you?
No, Your Honor. The last point that I would make in terms of the vagueness claim that we have here is that it is not enough to it does not provide adequate notice simply to be ordered to disperse. And Justice Kennedy made this point in his concurrence in Morales. He said that, although there are some police commands that will subject a citizen to prosecution for disobeying, whether or not the citizen knows why he's being ordered to do something, it doesn't follow that any unexplained police order must be obeyed without notice of the lawfulness of the order. And I think that's the problem here, and I think that goes back to the problematic terms in the ordinance. There's no way that a bystander who is, listening to speech would know whether or not a police officer on the scene deems the conduct of other persons to be a disturbance of the peace and quiet and annoying, inconvenient, or harmful. Like the ordinance in Morales, this ordinance does not provide adequate notice to persons of what is prohibited.
Do you believe under this ordinance a police officer could tell people to go away from a crime scene? Move on?
Well, I think it would depend on what the other person's, what are the triggering acts of the persons in the immediate vicinity.
Triggering acts, a crime scene, and the police are telling people to keep moving. Is that appropriate?
I think that would be appropriate, but that situation would also be covered if we had an ordinance that contained a public safety provision. And also, in Hodgkins, the Indiana juvenile curfew law contained an exception for First Amendment activities. I mean, it was problematic in that case because it was structured as an affirmative defense. But in this case, the city argues, it doesn't have to provide a First Amendment exception.
There's no real standard to that move on at a crime scene. It's just there. Just keep moving.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I see there's no standard established as to what has to be around the crime scene other than the police officer will tell you it's a crime scene. Let's move. Keep going.
I think that in that situation, it would be necessary for public safety and for, the execution of law enforcement.
Can you stop and ask him why do I have to move? What kind of a problem am I causing? I just want to stand here and see what's going on.
Well, you could certainly ask that of a police officer, but he would probably tell you
what the answer is going to be, don't you? Keep moving.
Right. I don't think that would be permissible, unless there was public safety problems.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Norberg?
I just have three very quick points. First of all, plaintiffs continue and have always taken a very crabbed perspective on the city's legitimate interest in this case. The safety issue is certainly a very important part of what the city is concerned with, but the city is also legitimately concerned with maintaining the public order in the public spaces, with making sure that there are not crowds and problems that will lead to less than safety issues, but legitimate adverse issues to bystanders and others in the bystanders. It's perfectly legitimate for the city also to have an ordinance like this in order to facilitate the job of the police officers. In many situations where there is a disturbance going on, it will be very useful, if not necessary, for a police officer to clear the area around the disturbance in order to best deal with the disturbance. That is a legitimate interest, and that is precisely what this ordinance allows the city to do. Second point I have to make is that the discussion of ample alternative channels of communication by my opposing counsel, and also the discussion of the heckler's veto, neglects to understand that they need to establish, in order to make a facial First Amendment challenge, that in every conceivable application of the ordinance, it denies ample alternative channels of communication. As we discuss in our papers, that is not the case because in many, if not most, situations, there won't be any expression occurring in the immediate vicinity.
Are you, maybe I misunderstand this, are you going back to your Salerno argument there? or not?
I'm going back to my taxpayers for Vincent argument, which posits the two types of facial First Amendment challenges. There's an overbreath, and there's also a challenge that in every conceivable application, the ordinance violates the right to free expression. And our position is that clearly in a situation where no one is exercising First Amendment rights, application of the ordinance cannot violate First Amendment rights. And the last point I wanted to make, just briefly to touch on the vagueness question, is that review of the standards that have been developed in the case law of this court and the Supreme Court show consistently that courts have been reasonable about what sort of specificity needs to be included in disorderly conduct ordinances like this. And our ordinance, including its incorporation of subsection A, which this court and the state courts of the state of Illinois have consistently held and at least indicated is sufficiently clear, fall well right within, squarely under the standards for clarity required in the disorderly conduct context. So unless the court has further questions, I would ask that you reverse the judgment of the district court and vacate the permanent injunction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.